Ave Maria in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Welcome to Ave Maria in the Afternoon, examining the world through the lens of faith from the heart of the Church to help us navigate the culture. Here's Dr. Marcus Peter.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for joining us on this hour of Ave Maria in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter. An outstanding joy and blessing to join all of you today. We've got a really intriguing lineup for this hour as well. We're going to begin by talking with a dear friend and mentor, Dr. Henry Russell, about the birthday, the anniversary of the birthday, of Jane Austen. I'm going to be the first to confess that I was not a huge fan of Jane Austen prior to Dr. Russell's influence. And it has a lot to do with the fact that I told myself, well, I don't want to read a girlish author. I had other male authors I wanted to read. But Jane Austen actually occupies a singular place in the history of Western literature. Her works possess a kind of genius. Many mistake her contributions for smallness, but an astute engagement of her work shows a brilliant analysis of the human condition. She depicts things like revolutions. Well, she actually avoids the greater strains of things like revolutions, wars, public spectacles. But she exposes things that are deeper. The tyranny of pride, for example, the fracturing of the human heart, the quiet descent into vice if not guarded, but the slow and painstaking education of conscience. These are things that really mark her brilliance, and they come out in her writings. Dr. Russell and I are going to unpack that for the first half hour, because parents, especially as you're listening to this, I would greatly encourage you and your children to pick up copies of Jane Austen's, for example, Pride and Prejudice, and to read them together and to think about the human condition in light of what she's highlighting so that we can become more contemplative individuals. We go on from there to speak with Dr. Jared Horvath. Laptops, tablets, smartphones, and other tech products were supposed to make learning easier. Of course, at their induction, we did not possibly conceive the detriment that they would bring to the human condition in terms of learning. They do serve to enhance our students' access to knowledge. It allows them to collaborate and exchange ideas at a rate that is unprecedented in human history. But the receipts are coming in, for want of a better expression, and they show an alarming trend. The more schools digitize, the worse their students perform. We're going to engage that with Dr. Horvath. All this after the headlines.
Thank you, Marcus, and good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Tuesday, December 16th. It's the feast of St. Adelaide of Burgundy. And today's news is brought to you by the nonprofit Revive app. Looking for peace in this chaotic world? A certified spiritual companion can help on the Revive app. That's R-E-V-I-V, and then the number 3. Police are confirming the gunman in the Bondi Beach mass shooting had ISIS flags in their car. Speaking at a Tuesday news conference, the New South Wales Police Commissioner, Ma Lanyon, also said there were IEDs in the vehicle.
We continue to work through the motive of this tragedy, and we'll continue to do so. And I think it's really important that our investigators continue to be given time to do that.
Director Rob Reiner's son is not making a court appearance anytime soon. It was reported Nick Reiner was expected to appear in court today, but his lawyer says he was not medically cleared yet, adding, he's day-to-day. Police are expected to announce charges later today against Nick Reiner in connection with the murder of his father and his mother, Michelle, with a knife at their home on Sunday. The gunman responsible for killing 2 people and wounding 9 others at Brown University remains on the loose. A person of interest was questioned, only to later be released following Saturday's shooting. Videos released on Monday show the suspect in dark clothing walking down streets near the university. The FBI is offering a $50,000 reward for information leading to an arrest. And President Trump will speak to the nation tomorrow. In a Truth Social post, the president said he will speak from the White House at 9 p.m. Eastern. He did not provide any details about what he will be speaking about. Trump ended his post by saying, "It has been a great year for our country, and the best is yet to come. From the AveMariaRadio.net news desk, I'm Dan McGraw.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. Today is the anniversary of the birthday of Jane Austen. And as many of you are aware, I am a lover of the written word, more than the printed word and definitely more than the digital word. And so I point that out because I believe that the reclamation of the great authors, the classic authors, will serve to bring about a real revitalization of culture. Joining me to have that conversation is a dear friend, Dr. Henry Russell, headmaster of the St. Augustine's Homeschool Enrichment Program, founded by him and his bride, Crystal. And the program begins in fall of 2005 with it began with 20 students in two living rooms and now tutors more than 140 students in three locations here in the greater Ann Arbor area. Dr. Russell, it's great to speak with you. How are you?
I'm well, thank you, Marcus. And it's great to speak with you on this 250th anniversary, right? Isn't it? You know, the country is going to be 250 from founding, and so and Jane Austen already is.
There must be a link.
I just can't help thinking there has to be.
Now, you would recall when we first met, I was, I think belligerent might be a very appropriate way to say it, when it came to her, Charlotte Bronte, and the Bronte sisters in general.
Yeah.
It was you that convinced me that there was because I was such a fan of especially the Russian authors,
right.
Solzhenitsyn, Dostoevsky, and their examination of the human condition.
Right.
But you convinced me that there was a subtle genius to Jane Austen that doesn't come out as easily for men. I'd like to begin there.
No, it's true. I mean, you have to really make young men read, especially Jane Austen and Pride and Prejudice. Although nowadays I started more and more with Northanger Abbey because it has a kind of slicing wit that young men appreciate, as does Pride and Prejudice. But it's subtler. It's more diffused over a longer book. Don't even get me started on the great Bronte sisters. Right now you're talking about a level of just emotional, turbulent genius, but guided by a keen intellect. And I think one of the reasons that women have found Jane Austen so powerful a friend, you know, and modern women really have, as you know.
May I jump? My bride thinks of Jane Austen that way.
Yeah, they love her. And I think for obvious, for reasons that almost sound haunting in these months after the events with Charlie Kirk, because she knows that if we do not get the relations between men and women correct, nothing else is going to be correct. And as you started to say right from the beginning, She doesn't write about the American Revolution, mm-hmm. although she was more or less born into it. She doesn't write about the French Revolution. She doesn't write about Napoleon. All of these things that, you know, she could have handled. But instead, she writes these books about how women need to use keen reason.
Mm.
And her heroines have very subtle distinctions about what is true and what is false, what is polite, what is impolite, what is noble, what is ignoble in the people around them. And I think modern women are hungry for that. A sense of a man, especially, who is courteous,
yeah.
You know, who knows how to speak to a woman as if she's a human being. But at the same time, Austen is not a cold fish, you know, as that great writer Charlotte Bronte thought she was mm-hmm. at first, which is kind of funny because some people think that about Charlotte Bronte. Instead, she's a woman who's absolutely insistent upon the need for true affection, true mm-hmm. love, instead of, you know, marriage for the sake of financial security.
That theme comes out quite a bit in her writings, and I'd like to press in on a very salient point you made. And this might even ruffle the feathers of many women listening right now, but like you mentioned, Jane Austen knows her place as a woman. And that's not a knock on feminine genius. She understands that the feminine genius shows itself better in the deeper, more introspective examination of human conditions. Right. So leave the considerations of the revolutions and the war to those people who think about those big picture questions, i.e. the men.
And who have to fight and die in those places.
Right.
I agree. And but, you know, she is powerfully aware that much needs to be amended. You know, she is speaking to a people who have perhaps, you know, turned marriage too much into a financial transaction. Or, on the other side of things, people who are slipping into a kind of romanticism where they trust their first wave of emotion toward another human being, mm-hmm. You know, emotions that are often clouded by vanity and sensual feelings. And that would easily lead to disaster and would lead to, again, a kind of enslavement is a silly word on one level, but a humbling of women below their status, mm-hmm. where they simply become the appendage of a romantic male.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Elizabeth Bennet isn't going to be anybody's appendage.
Yep.
She'll be his equal and his partner.
And Jane does, I was going to bring up exactly that. So you've got this great contraposition between Elizabeth Bennet and Mr. Darcy.
Yes.
And then you can contrapose that to the other characters in Pride and Prejudice. And you realize that she touches on all these extremes.
Exactly.
She wants to show the virtuous mean of marriage.
Exactly. And, you know, she does it beautifully. You know, her poor younger sister who just ruins her life and ends up married to a fool and a wastrel. And yet, fascinatingly, Elizabeth almost did herself,
mm-hmm.
right? She had her moment, her flirtation with romanticism of, oh, you know, he is so abused by Mr. Darcy.
Or the poor tortured soul. No one understands him, but I do.
Exactly. I do. And, you know, the two of us will amend all the social evils here. So, you know, it's a wonderful novel. Even her portrait of Elizabeth's father, mm-hmm. you know, who's a good man, who is decent and honorable and himself wise in many ways. And yet he has to learn that he has been too uninvolved in his daughter's upbringing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he has allowed his wife's nerves and shrill, you know, cacophony in the house to drive him too far into himself. You know, this modern malady that we see so often of men who just simply separate themselves mentally from the home.
And mm-hmm.
they're in it, but they just are. You know, instead of arguing and instead of trying to present their side of things, they just become silent. And, you know, the women then just become everything in the house. And, you know, how wrong that is. But Mr. Bennet realizes, you know, I've really failed you girls in some serious way.
And Mr. Bennet he becomes an exemplification for men reading the book, for example.
Yes.
To understand that, for example, as a husband and father, my active presence and role in the household is a non-negligible part of my vocation.
Absolutely.
My guest is Dr. Henry Russell. He is the headmaster of the St. Augustine Homeschool Enrichment Program here in the greater Ann Arbor area. It's an outstanding program that forms students in the light of virtue, of truth, goodness, and beauty. And we're talking about the heritage of Jane Austen, particularly on this day, the 250th anniversary of her birthday. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria mutual funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
You like pizza? Me too. And for that, we can thank our friend, Tom Monahan. First, he starts with $900 and opens one pizza shop. Then it's worldwide, thousands of shops. But all this was just a warm-up for his greatest achievement yet. He built a university.
God inspired Tom to build up generations of men and women who have a hunger to reach the world for Christ. This place is Ave Maria University.
Visit avemaria.edu to see what's next.
Our world is filled with noise, work, screens, and endless demands. But Christ calls us to step away and listen. The nonprofit Revive app offers one-on-one virtual conversations with certified spiritual companions who help you deepen your relationship with God, discern His will, and find peace. If even the saints needed spiritual guidance, how much more do we? Your first two sessions are free. Download the Revive app today. That's R-E-V-I-V. And then the number 3.
Ever get asked one of those tough questions, like, do Catholics worship Mary? And in that moment, you freeze? Truthfully, the Catholic AI app gives you answers in seconds rooted in scripture, tradition, and the magisterium. Whether you're navigating a tough conversation, deepening your faith, or looking for daily spiritual guidance, Truthfully helps you know, live, and defend the Catholic faith. Truthfully can be found in the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's Truthfully, T-R-U. T-H-L-Y.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter, talking with Dr. Henry Russell, who is the headmaster of the St. Augustine Homeschool Enrichment Program here in the Greater Ann Arbor area. He is a literary genius, and we're talking about the wondrous heritage of Jane Austen to the world of Western literature. Dr. Russell, to draw a little back into the grander scheme of the conversation, one of the things that you brought up over the break is that reading good works of literature makes you a happier person. As someone who was brought up in a complete empiricist, materialist, overt efficiency mindset, I've seen this firsthand. Can you please speak into that for our listeners?
Well, at the broadest level, great literature teaches us how to be human. It teaches us a variety of behaviors that, frankly, we don't have time to exhibit all of them or to experience all of them. And frankly, that if we did, it would very possibly be horribly self-destructive for us. But we see in literature incarnated what works in life and what doesn't work in life. And as we read great literature and we think with it and feel with it, and approve of this character and disapprove of another or say, oh my goodness, you are going to be terribly, destructive to yourself and others. We're literally training our own emotions in a way that is perhaps less dangerous than just going out and doing these things ourselves. Fascinatingly, in particular, Austen, her years, 1775, right? The Romantic Revolution has not really fully occurred. It won't until Wordsworth writes. And so what has been abroad has been a kind of cold, hard, materialist vision of the world, dog eat dog. And sometimes it could be very funny and elegant, as in, Henry Fielding's Tom Jones, or especially in the restoration playwrights like Sheridan and others, and where you know that they were witty, they were ironic, they were sharp, and it's, you know, they could tear each other to pieces. with you know, just the most genteel sort of phraseology, and then take snuff afterwards. And she was, you know, that was kind of the window on literature that was closest to her. And she learned a great deal from them. You know, her wit can be very acerbic when she wants it to be. But then there were the, you know, the more pre-romantic, if you will, authors like Sir Walter Scott, and others, you know, who wanted to, you know, give us a vision of a glorious humanity. But, you know, it seems to me that Jane Austen is just, she's a Christian. You know, when you say, what is she after? What is she doing? She's nobody's feminist. She's not trying to amend the problem of women and their difficult financial situation. I mean, she lived the difficult financial situation to some degree. But everybody lived a difficult financial situation. It's 1775, for crying out loud. You know, the Industrial Revolution and capitalism has not produced the kind of overflowing wealth that would permit, you know, some generosity for the poor. If you became poor, male or female, it was difficult. It was dirty, it was dark, and it was full of alcoholics. She's not trying to, you know, to fix these things. She knows better. But she's looking at people and expecting a Christian and decent way of behavior from them. And we love that in her. You know, we all want that kind of decency again. We have a sense that America was once more like that, you know. We might have funny accents, you know, and we may not have as much, you know, class distinction.
We might throw our tea in the harbor as opposed to in our teacups.
Right.
But we had that sense of a collective virtue.
Exactly. And the, you know, the founding fathers appealed to that, and they knew they could appeal to it.
Now, effectively reading great works of literature, but let's focus on Jane Austen. What that's going to do is, if you allow it to happen, it softens and reforms a worldview about human persons and therefore about the ebbs and flows of society. Can you please share why that's so important, especially today?
Well, you know, there was a time when we could rely on society as a broader whole to provide that vision. You know, you could expect those expectations to be put forth in front of you in the schoolroom. And for example, for myself, even, you know, in the 50s, well, 60s, those were presented to me in the schoolroom. And I, you know, I was grateful for that. And I responded to that. You would see it reflected in the media. You would see it reflected in the way political figures talked and talked about each other. In short, it was a cultural consensus. And it was built on, among other things, books like those written by Austen and the Brontes. Of course, it was built ultimately upon the Bible. But, you know, these lesser but great authors would be able to incarnate it in ways that were perhaps closer and more contemporaneous. And so these stories do shape us morally. They, at the very least, they remind us of what we already know. And at the best, they push us, they challenge us to go on farther. And they inspire us to be better than ourselves. We need these. And right now we need them desperately because of the various parts of society that I've mentioned. So many of them have broken down almost completely. And, you know, really sorrowful to say, the relations between husbands and wives and children have broken down so much in so many families. Obviously, we're not talking about everybody. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we need to both pray and call forth a revival of the Christian family, a family that treats each other, you know, as if every member is an image of Christ. And then there will be manners, and there will be a certain delicacy of understanding of feelings and a certain delicacy of how we speak to each other rather than just using the roughest language that comes to mind. So these books remind us we have been better and we can be better again. I mean, does that seem enough, or are you thinking of something beyond that?
No, I'm realizing that because of what because of what you just said, therefore, reading things like Pride and Prejudice, Sense and Sensibility, they're going to challenge the areas in our souls that are hardened, that are deformed, that right. have been misinformed and malformed by the present culture.
That's correct. That's correct. And they will strengthen those parts of us that are still healthy. You know, they'll say, yes, you're right about that. It is best to act in that particular way. You know, to admit that you've been wrong, to admit that you've looked at somebody, you know, in a way that really isn't seeing them, but a cartoon of them.
My guest is Dr. Henry Russell. We've been talking about the legacy of Jane Austen. I couldn't recommend you picking up her writings enough. And read one of her works as a family. As Dr. Russell was mentioning, there are copious works of hers that we can start with. Dr. Russell is the headmaster of the St. Augustine Homeschool Enrichment Program here in the Greater Ann Arbor area. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
When the need for senior care arises, home is where the heart is. Visiting Angels provides home care for mom or dad up to 24 hours per day, including personal care, meals, and light housework. You may select your professional caregiver with Visiting Angels. More information at visitingangels.com or at 877-374-LIVE. That's 877-374-LIVE. Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care.
Ave Maria in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization: Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
Ave Maria School of Law is the Roman Catholic law school in the United States. Consistently ranked in the Princeton Review as one of the best and most conservative law schools, as well as pre-law's most devout law school. Ave Maria School of Law provides a traditional legal education while emphasizing how the law intersects with the Catholic intellectual tradition and natural law philosophy. Ave Maria School of Law, unabashedly Catholic, consistently excellent. For more information, visit avemarialaw.edu.
This program brought to you in part by Ave Maria Florida, a big kind of small town where golf carts take you everywhere and there's always something fun around the corner. Discover championship golf, resort-style amenities, and a town center full of shopping and dining. With Ave Maria University and Ave Maria Catholic Church at its heart, it's a community full of connection and charm. More than 25 model homes are available for viewing. More information can be found at avemaria.com. That's avemaria.com.
At Ave Maria Radio, we understand how hard it can be to keep faith at the center when life feels overwhelming. For nearly 30 years, we've been a trusted voice, bringing truth, encouragement, and the gospel into homes every day. Please remember to support your Catholic radio station this Christmas. Your gift today ensures this mission continues into the new year. Visit avemariaradio.net to be part of the mission. Together, we can keep Christ at the heart of every conversation.
Christ is the answer with Father John Ricardo.
Are you passionate about Jesus? Are you zealous for Jesus? Are you fervent for Jesus? Are we fervent for the gospel? Are we passionate about helping this world come to know him? Is that true? not true for most people in the church. Is Jesus my best friend? Is he your best friend? I'm looking around the church. There's a set of guys in here who have great man caves. As I was praying this morning, I felt like the Lord said, hey, when are you going to come to my man cave? Like, you guys think a flat screen TV is really cool. Well, you should see what I got to offer. Because I and I alone, he says, can really give you what it is you're longing for. Whoever it is we're rooting for right now, they're going to lose eventually. Or whatever it is that's occupying our time, one day we're going to realize it really wasn't that important. Why aren't we hanging out with the one who alone can show us what life is really all about? When was the last time you hung out in the Lord's man cave?
Advent is here, and Ave Maria Radio wants to walk beside you every day as we move towards the birth of Jesus. When you visit AveMariaRadio.net, you can join our Advent mission and receive short, powerful, and engaging daily videos that help you enter the mystery of the Incarnation with new clarity and devotion. Go to the slider at AveMariaRadio.net, sign up, and take your place in this joyful journey to the manger.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. Laptops, tablets, smartphones, and other tech products were supposed to make learning easier. They would enhance our students' access to knowledge and allow them to collaborate and exchange ideas. But the receipts are coming in, as one would say, and they show an alarming trend. In fact, we now know that the more schools digitize, the worse off their students are in terms of academic performance. Joining me to talk about this is Dr. Jared Horvath. He's a neuroscientist, educator, and best-selling author, specializing in human learning and brain development. He's also the author of The Digital Delusion, How Classroom Technology Harms Our Kids' Learning and How to Help Them Thrive Again. Jared, thank you very much for joining us. How are you?
Good. Thank you for having me on.
I'm very glad to speak with you. This is an extremely important topic, and I'm glad for this book. This is well written. I want to begin by asking you to define the concept of ed tech and its origins.
Yes, that's a big question, but I think we can narrow it down to ed tech stands for educational technology, mm-hmm. and it's any student-facing digital tool that allows kids access to the internet. So we've had technology in schools for over 60 years, things like desktop computers and question machines. But realistically, it's been since 2000 that kids have been getting these internet-connected devices. We put them down in front of them, and we assume this is going to help them learn. And unfortunately, as I mentioned, that's just not the case so far.
It really, in fact, like you've mentioned, the studies are proving that it's not only not the case, it's quite the reverse. But we were sold a narrative to bring us to where we are right now. And the narrative was that classical learning and the traditional systems of education and the formation of the human soul were broken. And so technology was the solution forward.
Yeah. And I think that's largely thanks due to tech companies and TED Talks. I think I hate to pin it all on TED Talks, but realistically, that was when messages started to spread pretty widely through parents and public that education is broken. Ed kills creativity. Our kids aren't learning enough. And of course, if you're going to say there's a problem, you have to come up with a solution. And so the solution was, let's give kids computers. It will personalize learning. It will allow them to guide their own learning journey. And all of it sounded really good, but none of us stopped and said, where is your evidence? Where is the proof that your tools can do what you're saying it can do? And 20 years later, we now have that proof, and that proof shows that, exactly as you said, the more time kids spend on tech, the lower their scores, their learning, their performance drops. It's not a little bit as bad, and a little bit more is no worse. It's the more we do it, the worse it's getting. And since COVID, we're doing a lot more of it.
I want to drive this a little deeper, because we were also convinced that the more we introduce multimedia to the learning, I remember being schooled in this, the more we introduce multimedia into the learning experience, the more enhanced the learning experience is. We now have data that proves the complete opposite.
Yeah, it turns out multimedia is only as good as the pedagogy behind it. So pedagogy is basically just, how are we teaching you? And when we compare pedagogy with high visuals and stimulation and stuff to the exact same pedagogy without all that stimulation, we see the exact same outcome. It was never the visuals. It was never the audio driving our learning. It was the teaching behind all of that driving our learning. And realistically, so a lot of people then say, well, I guess it's even Stevens then. Whether we use it or not is irrelevant. Not so fast. It turns out the more visuals and audio we put in, that's not helping, but it does have the opportunity to hurt. With more audios and visuals, we give kids more chance to start multitasking, moving their attention, interacting with things that are irrelevant to the learning. So they might not help, but we definitely have data showing that they can hurt. So going back to more traditional pedagogy seems to be kind of a nice solution to some of that.
And part of that reclamation of traditional pedagogy is also admitting that we've been sold another narrative that kids know how to learn themselves and that we need to do this kind of kid-driven learning that's greatly supplemented by technology. Tell us why that path was detrimental to sound intellectual formation.
And isn't it interesting that I don't think any of us would have listened to that narrative in any other realm? No one assumes that a kid can just figure out how to drive. I'm not going to throw my kid in a pool and be like, discovery learning, you'll figure this out. But when it came to like traditional stuff, reading, writing, arithmetic, we were told that if you just give kids access to the internet, they will sort it out themselves. And realistically, I think this comes down, there was a study done in the early 2000s, and I say study in quotes because there's actually no data for it, but we know it happened, but no one knows what happened. But a guy put an iPad basically into a slum in India in a wall, and he just left it there. And he said, what's going to happen? And he came back reporting that kids taught themselves how to use the machine and taught them how to do all this interesting stuff. And that was kind of the birth of this self-directed learning kind of movement. In hindsight now, when people went and checked on the data, it turned out the iPad was stolen and vandalized and kids gamed on it. They didn't learn anything on it, but the movement had already started. But what we know now is, same as anything, once you're past the age of about 5 or 6, the brain flips into a new mode for the rest of your life that we're going to call specific processing. When you're a very young kid, it's in general mode. If you hear a language, you will learn a language. If you hear 2 languages, you'll learn 2 languages. But right around the age 5 or 6, when we start school, the brain flips, and now the best way for the brain to develop is through guided instruction. Rather than having to figure things out or just being purely exposed to things, you'll learn them. Now the best way to learn is to have someone who already understands it walk you through the process. That makes it fast, that makes it easier, and that's always what we've been doing in school. And as we stepped away from that, learning, of course, goes down.
Now, there are other myths that unfortunately compound on exactly what you just said about the learning process, that intelligent tutors make kids more intelligent, especially ones that correspond to the kid's individual learning style.
Yeah. And this feeds into the modern AI stuff, too. I think with AI especially, tech is saying we can adapt to exactly what your kid needs when they need it, when they want it. There's 2 kind of issues with that. One, we've known for a long time that things like learning styles and choose your own adventure learning, first, they don't really seem to matter. When we adapt our lessons, our pedagogy, to the content rather than the learner, then everyone appears to learn better. And it makes sense. If I want to teach you how to dance, whether you like visuals, whether you like audio, everyone is going to learn better if we get up and dance. If I want to teach you how to paint, I don't care if you're an auditory or you like reading. If you paint, you're going to learn better. So when we align pedagogy with content, everyone learns better. And more importantly, when you let kids select their own learning strategies, you fall into what's called the fluency illusion. So human beings have this really weird issue that the easier something is for us, we develop more confidence and assume we understand that stuff better. Mm-mm. So let's say I'm studying something. If I study in a very easy way, like I just reread this passage 10 times, my guess is I must really understand it. That was easy. And I overestimate what I actually learned. Meanwhile, kids who go through hardships, if you do some study method like flashcards, that's really difficult. You might think you're learning less because it's hard, but that's where you're actually learning more. So when you let kids pick their own study strategies, most of them go to the easy stuff and they trick themselves into thinking, I'm really getting this. I'm really good at this. When in truth, when you let the teacher select the harder things, the things that kids almost invariably would never choose to do, it makes them feel like they're learning less, But when we test them, without a doubt, they are learning more. So this is where teachers will always be important, because they understand how to push past that fluency illusion.
This is what has always concerned me about every newfangled theory of pedagogy that comes out of schools of education. Every 5 years or so, you're going to see new frameworks come out that tout that this is going to be the new way forward, when everything that your book has shown is really what needs to be done is to go back to the tried and true methods of sound logic and the exploration of truth. I'm talking with Dr. Jarrett Horvath. He is the author of The Digital Delusion. This really is a very well-written book. It's about how classroom technology has harmed our children and their learning processes. But he also presents us, toward the later part of the book, steps and pathways forward to help them thrive intellectually, let alone academically again. Continuing on the other side of the break, stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
Support for this Ave Maria radio program comes in part by the non-for-profit St. Anthony Services. Are you shopping for mortgage products, Catholic investing, Catholic health, real estate, or estate planning? StAnthonyServices.org can help you find a Catholic professional for these needs. They regularly connect faithful citizens with faith-based professionals that share our Christian values. More information at StAnthonyServices.org or 877-LIFE-US1.
Hi, I'm Angie. Did you know a billboard can save a baby's life? It's true. You can make a difference this holiday by helping us spread the pro-life message to reach those who are struggling with an unplanned pregnancy. Our billboards and ads feature our 800 hotline for help, which connects people to pro-life centers nationwide that can assist with free medical help, baby supplies, and more. Won't you join us in this season of giving? Please make a gift today. Visit ProLifeAcrossAmerica.org. That's ProLifeAcrossAmerica.org.
Pope Francis said, "The key that opens the door to faith is prayer." Join St. Paul Street Evangelization by running a prayer station in the public square. You don't need to be a professional apologist or theologian. Just listen to the needs of the people you encounter. Offer encouragement, take prayer requests, and pray with people. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Ever get asked one of those tough questions, like, do Catholics worship Mary? And in that moment, you freeze? Truthfully, the Catholic AI app gives you answers in seconds rooted in scripture, tradition, and the magisterium. Whether you're navigating a tough conversation, deepening your faith, or looking for daily spiritual guidance, Truthfully helps you know, live, and defend the Catholic faith. Truthfully can be found in the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's Truthfully. Truthly.
Steve and Janet Ray here, announcing we are back in the Holy Land, ready to introduce you to our favorite places in the world, the land where God walked. Mass at the most holy sites, pray the mysteries of the rosary where they happened, and experience the Bible in vivid color. We have led over 100 groups through this land, sharing the whole story of salvation. Of all the pilgrimages in all of the world, this is the one you should not miss.
Find the Ave Maria Radio travel tab at avemariaradio.net.
Does the fourth commandment only order us to honor our father and our mother? According to the Catholic Catechism, it also obliges us to give honor and respect to all whom for our good God has vested with his authority. Respecting the fourth commandment, says the Catechism, brings its own reward, not only with spiritual fruits, but temporal benefits of peace and prosperity, whereas failure to observe the commandment brings harm to individuals and communities. We are reminded that marriage and the family is ordered to the good of the spouses and the procreation and education of children. The Catechism states a man and a woman united in marriage together with their children is what forms a family. God instituted the human family when he created man and woman and instructed them to increase and multiply. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
Have you ever been so grief-stricken and so heart-sick that you can't see God? You can't see God in the tragedy. You can't see God in that cross. You can't see God in that sin. Why? You're enveloped in that grief. You're enveloped in fear. And God is out the window. You don't see Him standing right next to you.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter, talking with Dr. Jarrett Horvath. He is a neuroscientist, educator, and best-selling author, specializing in human learning and brain development. And we are talking about his new book called The Digital Delusion, How Classroom Technology Harms Our Kids' Learning and How to Help Them Thrive Again. Jarrett, we got cut off, but I want to jump right into what you were saying earlier about presuppositions about education, that every newfangled theory coming out of departments of education across the world, universities, they all tend to lean towards validating ed tech, despite the data proving that it's detrimental to our children's learning outcomes. Can you please speak to that?
Yeah, I don't know why, but education just runs in these cyclical fads where this is, you know, where you see it most is in the, we called it the reading wars, where we used to teach kids how to read by basically reading. Here's a letter, here's a sound, put them together, sound out the word. Mm-hmm. And then a fad came out, whole word reading. We realized that didn't work, so we went back. Then another fad came out, sight reading, and that didn't work, so we went back. For some reason, people just don't want to assume that school, the way it traditionally has been, works. But it does. Like you said, we keep going back to it time and time again. And I could argue for 2,000 years, no matter what we try and change, we keep coming back to the same basic system because human beings have a way to learn. We are biologically built in a very specific way. And if we can align with that building, learning is easier. And we just keep coming back to the same, what we'll call traditional methods again and again.
Because of what you've just said about the cyclical reality, it's getting really concerning that we are not willing to revisit classical methods of education that we know have yielded fruit for millennia.
Yeah. And isn't it trippy that there was, I think when the tech stuff started really coming along, it was the higher class schools, like the private schools, the schools with money were taking in tech. And if you were at one of the poor, the lesser schools, you were using these old, outdated methods. But if you fast forward to today, I was just looking at some data this morning, the schools most likely to not use tech now are the rich schools, are the have schools. They're going back to those classical methods because they realize it works. It's now the kids stuck in the more public education sphere who are now stuck with all these tools. So it was like the rich schools tried this as an experiment. They decided it failed, have gone back to normal, but the other schools took it on board and they can't seem to reverse out of it. So a lot of the public schools now are just heavy tech and it's harming their learning, unfortunately, growing that divide between the haves and the have-nots.
You have an anecdote about exactly this. There was an affluent school, 12 years on ed tech, you know, digital learning, and then the principal decided to switch course, but he decided to do so quietly. Can you please share with us, first of all, why quietly, but what was the outcome?
Yeah, I think a lot of people, when you try and push back against tech, you get a lot of anger from parents and from outsiders who don't really know what's going on in the classroom. Mm-hmm. And so he just decided, look, we're going to step away from tech. We're going to step away from traditional grading systems. We're just going to go back to kind of teaching and learning. And his school went from like the bottom quarter, and so this was back in Australia, went from one of the bottom quarter in the country to top 10% in the country in a single year. But the joke was he couldn't tell anyone because his move back to learning wasn't to improve test scores. It was just because he knew that was going to be better. And if he were to go out there and say, hey, look, our test scores are higher, he felt that was going to go against his entire motion of just, if we focus on learning, then the outcome doesn't matter. So oddly enough, when you go back to just focusing on learning, and it's a good rule of thumb. If you focus on performance, how am I going to pass a test? How am I going to ace this exam? you'll perform well, but there's no guarantee you're going to learn. But if you focus on learning, do I really understand this stuff? Then you'll perform just fine because you will genuinely get it. And when someone asks you a question, you'll be able to answer a question about it.
Without getting too technical, if we can also address the three core issues that you bring up that ed tech simply doesn't want to acknowledge, the first being the mechanism of attention and the need to need to reorder that in our students.
Yeah, I think if you had to say what's the worst thing you can do for learning, my answer is always multitasking. The way the human brain works is we have to be focused on one thing if we want to learn that thing. But once we start jumping between multiple things, attention goes down, memory goes down, learning goes down. It's just bad. Why does this matter? When we use screens for learning, we hope kids will be able to focus on it. But you got to remember, if kids age 8 to 18 across the U.S. spend over 2,500 hours per year using computers to multitask, which is the worst thing we can do for learning. So now when we sit a kid down with a screen and we're like, time to focus and learn, most of them will only make it about 6 minutes before they start multitasking because that's what they've trained themselves to do on these machines. That's when learning goes down. And I don't see, unless we take screens out of the home, I don't see how we can ever overcome that. After 4 years of having a computer at home, kids have spent over 10,000 hours training themselves to do the one thing they can't do on these machines if we want them to learn. And we're surprised when they can't overcome that training in the classroom.
How has the utilization of digital technology influenced the more human capacities of the students? Because learning is meant to form the whole person. So questions like empathy, for example.
Yeah, and I think this is a really good point, too, is when we interact online, our bodies don't recognize that as actual human interaction. And we can track that with chemicals. When we interact with people live and in person, we get one set of chemicals. When we interact online, we get a different set. And unfortunately, when we interact online, the set of chemicals we get make us more lonely, make us more isolated. We start to feel sadder and we start to disengage. So it turns out one of the biggest drivers we have of learning is an empathetic relationship. When a kid and a student resonate together, learning goes up wildly. In fact, I tell my students, if you can pick between having an AI tutor that gives you exactly the information you need at exactly the moment you need it, or liking your teacher, always pick liking your teacher because you will learn more. So that's a very human aspect that we were built to learn from each other. We're not built to learn from screens. We're not built to learn from cups. We have inborn mechanisms that say when we're with another human being, learning will increase. Mm. And the more we use screens to avoid interacting with other humans, you can imagine that's a big driver of learning loss.
You've got a greater consideration that you highlight as well, which is the question of skill transfer, that we underestimate how even cognitive processes, the reality of learning truth, is the result of having observed an individual do it, learning how to do it, and then transferring that skill to other facets of human existence.
And that is, if you think about it, that's got to be the end game of most education. Like, mm-hmm. I don't teach my kids math so they can do a math problem in my room. I'm teaching you math so you can transfer that ability. So now you can do math at home mm-hmm. when you're balancing your checkbook or whatever it's going to be. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, transfer is incredibly difficult. And so two ways we know to boost transfer. One is called variability. Basically, the more variable context you learn a skill in, the easier it is to transfer that skill. Now you can assume the real world is highly variable. Every time we pick up a pencil, it's slightly different. Every time we sit at a table, it's slightly different. Computers are highly uniform. It doesn't matter what computer you're at. If I touch the letter L, it's always going to come out the exact same way. So because of the narrowness, the specificity of a screen, when kids learn on a screen, they typically struggle to move it off of a screen. But the other issue then with that is what we call additive and subtractive. When you learn a new skill in a very difficult manner, like let's say you learn to drive using a manual transmission, but then I put you in a very simple context. Now drive a car with an automatic transmission. Transfer is incredibly easy. Most mm-hmm. people can do it. But flip it. If you start in the easy setting, I get drive in an automatic, mm-hmm. and now I put you in a hard setting, can you drive a manual? The answer is going to be no. I can't transfer my skill because I didn't learn the nuances needed to do that. When kids learn on a computer, computers by definition make everything incredibly easy. Mm. So they are learning in the easiest possible manner. which means when we try and move them into the real world with variation and difficulty, most of them won't be able to take their skills off. So they can learn, and so long as they've got the computer in front of them, they can show you that learning. But if you try and test that learning off of the screen, you won't see it transfer out.
What can we say then to proponents of ed tech who argue that, well, we've only been implementing ed tech for just a little over a decade into two decades, and we need more time for the relationship between learning and technology to mature?
The good news with that is we can actually draw the data all the way back to 1962. That was the first official meta-analysis of all of this stuff. And the impact of technology has not changed. It is literally exactly the same today when we analyze it as it was in 1962. So to those people, I usually say, you've had six decades to get your data. How much longer are you expecting us to run this failed experiment? And it's harming our kids and our generations. How many more kids are you going to put at stake until you accept that, yeah, this isn't working? And to that, you could also point to all the biological stuff. It's not just a matter of I need more time to overcome the attention obstacle. The attention obstacle is stuck in our brain. No one is going to overcome it. You can't. The best software in the world can't overcome hundreds of thousands of years of development. We are who we are, and we'd be much better suited acknowledging, yes, this is who human beings are. Let's adapt learning to the person rather than trying to adapt the person to our new technology.
Jarrett, this was truly outstanding. This is also a really beautifully written book. Thank you for making the time with us.
Thank you so much for having me on, and thank you for even considering it. It's such a big topic, and I'm glad you're diving in.
No, I'm glad, and I'm looking forward to future conversations. This is extremely important.
Absolutely. I'm all yours whenever you want.
My guest has been Dr. Jarrett Horvath. He is the author of The Digital Delusion. This is a very well-written book. I greatly encourage everyone to get a copy of it on Amazon, The Digital Delusion by Dr. Jarrett Horvath. It's about how classroom technology has harmed our children's learning, but how we can help them thrive again by the reclamation of core principles pertaining to the formation of the human intellect. Thank you for joining us. I'm Marcus Peter.